falar desse transformation between S and V, which is as supersymmetric quantum electrodynamics, and which is a supersymmetric extension of the order of quantum electrodynamics. And correspondingly, we're considering Lorentz violation extension for S and V. So one might wonder why, in general, people are considering Lorentz violation in their theories. But in general, it has been known that all singulars of the nature has passed certain tests and are only known up to a certain precision. And, that's why one may wonder whether Lorentz symmetry, which lies really at the foundation of quantum field theory, may also be somehow not exact, maybe broken or whatever. And there are certain hints for that. One of them is that we know that there exists a preferred frame of the cosmic microwave background, and by itself it's not a violation of the Lorentz symmetry, but if it's some kind of matter associated with the quintessence, for example, which is coupled with the standard model, then it might exhibit itself as a manifest itself as evaluation along the symmetry. Other things come from string theory where there are different classes which are condensed field strength gauge fields, and they also be considered as preferred frames in any kind of permanent constant vector throughout space that is considered a background vector which signifies Lorentz violation, and that is what people are hunting for. And another thing comes from quantum gravity, where there was some prediction that Lorentz violation might be broken in many different reasons, and one of them is, for example, the modification of particle dispersion relations. Most constraints on Lorentz violation come from either astrophysical observations or terrestrial experiments, which the most precise of which are torsion balance experiments, where a magnetized disk hangs on a spring and in a magneto-isolated shell. And if there is an interaction between electron spin with any preferred frame, that there should be a non-zero torque. And despite this is a quantum mechanical system, it provides one of the best results. So the way people study effects of Lorentz violations is mostly within the framework of effective field theory. It is so because effective field theory allows one not to know about the higher standing theory which does create effective Lorentz violation. So one assumes that there is an ultra-wide theory in the landscape which has Lorentz invariance, but then it somehow gets either spontaneously broken. We don't know how, and we need to know how in order to derive some constraints. And so what people do, they consider any type, any an arbitrary kind of effective low energy action and parameterizing by some tensors in case of Lorentz violation. So those guys, AD, etc., are background vectors of tensors. This is the famous term science for. And so in regular quantum electrodynamics, Lorentz violation starts in dimension 3. It means that one can only write interactions which has a minimum dimension, mass dimension 3, and then are 5. Those have been studied quite well, and observations show that none of them actually exist. They've been pretty severely constrained by experiment.
And H minimum, F minimum.
So, what?
Why can I write down a dimension 2 of H minimum, F minimum?
H minimum, F minimum.
Yeah.
That's it only really. In the case of the gauge field, it's trace zero. So, I mean, I don't set the goal here to list all the operators of quantum dynamics, but it seems to be all of them. And this is just to let you know what it looks like. How normally we proceed to do that. Because those operators are on dimension 3, and the Lagrangian density is dimension 4, the Wilson coefficients have to be massive, have to have a massive dimension. There is no other scale but the ultraviolet scale, perhaps the Planck scale, which we can attribute to it. And then there is a big problem, because this actually induces quite strong interactions, which would already ruin everything we see around. And that's why one might wonder that, well, they're probably too small, and that's why we don't observe them. But actually, if they're dimension 5 operators, or higher dimensional operators, they will would have induced anyway dimension 3 operators via radiative directions. And this is how it's done, so how it happens. If you have a dimension 5 operator, which has a dimensional inverse mass, and while loop effects, it gets high in the height and y, the ultraviolet scale, which is basically the same as m. And it induces the same kind of interaction, which are very strong. And that means that we also have to somehow fine-tune the dimension 5 operators either. But then there is no talk about Lorentz violation at all, because we have to tune everything. There is no Lorentz violation then. If we indeed want to study, we need to somehow solve this natural problem. And one of the solutions has been shown that if there are some simulators, discrete or other, they might prohibit the existence of this of lower dimension operators, which create certain problems. And one of such simulators is supersymmetry. It has been shown that in gauge supersymmetric models, particularly in minimal supersymmetric standard model, Lorentz violation starts at dimension 5, and there is no supersymmetric dimension 3 operators.
Are there other symmetries you can use besides supersymmetry?
Well, as I say, gauge symmetry is mine, and discrete symmetries.
Well, your previous slide had gauge symmetries in it, right?
Yeah. But as we actually discussed yesterday, in the case of super symmetry, gauge symmetry allows one. So if we can adjust super symmetry.
No, but I'm saying, supposing that I have a resistant super symmetry, I just want to know what's my menu of options for getting rid of dimension three terms. Super symmetry seems like it's a lot of
For example, CPT symmetry, because odd dimensional operators are CPT breaking. So if you insist on CPT, you at least get rid of dimension 3. You have the dimension 4 still. But
so the thing is, is it true that supersymmetry is the only one that gets rid of dimension 4?
That I don't know. I'm not sure about that.
Does there exist another proposal to get rid of dimension 4?
I don't know. But I don't know how much people bother about that indeed, but I don't know.
Is there a simple way to see why supersymmetry gets the problem with dimension four is that you've got the time terms and the space terms, and the Lorentz invariant relates them, but generally they're not related and you have the Lorentz invariant. And is there a way to see why supersymmetry would relate time to space? Because it seems like supersymmetry is you got things involving space, things involving time, but you're not really enforced to relate time to space.
Well, it doesn't relate time to space. What it does is just because of itself, it greatly restricts the number of operators quite a lot. And it doesn't actually have to do with Lorentz symmetry. So we don't know about Lorentz symmetry.
Right, that's the surprising thing. I mean, and I kind of know the argument here. If I just wrote down D term and F term, it looks like there's no derivatives there. But I worry that maybe there's a term that we have. The normal rules for writing supersymmetric theories were derived assuming Lorentz invariants. And I'm wondering if maybe there might be invariants that are being missed in a non-Lorentz invariant versus version of supersymmetry. Just given that it seems funny that time and space aren't getting related to one another. Or there should be some way to see why supersymmetry forces time and space to get related to each other.
But I think it would already, if this is something very simple, it would already be known. Because people have been studying Lorentz relating extended model for quite a long.
You actually have a simple physical argument as to why the dimension four term would go away.
Aside from experimental arguments,
yeah,
that they do go away, I don't have any other justification.
Sorry, I don't understand what you mean by relates time and space.
Well, I understand the big selling point here is that this is the only proposal that gets rid of the dimension four terms. And the reason the dimension four terms is so hard to get rid of is that in the effect of the run, you can always write things like for scalar field phi dot squared and separately grad phi squared. And then the normalization is separate for the two, and that's why every particle has its own speed of propagation. And Lorentz invariants are, of course, related them all to each other, time and space. And so for some reason, supersymmetry is not allowing you to write down those two separate grad phi squared and the phi dot squared terms. And it'd be nice to understand why that's true, because it seems like the symmetry itself is pretty time related to time and space. So why are they being forced to be linked to one?
I don't know the answer, but okay. So if supersymmetry is broken, we know that it's broken, then dimension three operators still get induced, and that is good because that's how we can put constraints on dimension five operators. Because what we observe is mostly dimension, or not observe, dimension three operators. It's something which we experimentally can severely constrain. And dimension five are also able to constrain, but it's easier to deal with dimension three. So if there are dimension five operators, then they would induce dimension three on wire supersymmetry breaking. And that is how it happens. It's some loop factor times the soft mass squared And this softener must now plays the role of the ultraviolet cutoff, which is certainly much better because it's not the length mass squared, because that would be a huge reduction of pretty much observable effects. But the soft mass is of the order of 1 keV. So this might solve the hard problem. This is kind of a naturalness problem of the 93 of lower dimension operators. So what we are trying to pursue here is that the naturalness problem doesn't exist, and in other words, has been solved. Also, we aim to put constraints on the laws violating coefficients of scalar quantum electrodynamics. Also, so in part there are some purely theoretical questions as to whether by our modifying the theory with new interactions we have induced any, or we have disturbed it, such that there are some anomalies now don't match the technology. And also we drive the linearization through flow of these operators, and this is justified because the scale where the Lorentz-like physics gets generated is the sum of ultraviolet high scale, but the observations are needed at a lower scale. And one needs to correctly evolve the rules and coefficients down to the observation scale. But it doesn't appear to be quite formidable, but it must not really know that. Also, as I said, supersymmetry breaking is the important step in constraining the Lorentz spiral physics. And also we're on the way, we show and try to resolve the long-standing disputes about the transcendence operator, for which many people have claimed that it gets induced by Lorentz-related physics, and other people think that it doesn't. We also support this point of view.
Which one, that doesn't?
That it doesn't. And as I said, we studied what kind of effects the installation dimension five leads to. So we started with the SQD. Supersymmetric quantum electrodynamics is described by two cross superfluids, and it has to be two of them in order to be able to write gauge invariant mass torques, which are those guys. And here, this is the kinetic term for matter, and this is kinetic term for the gauge field. The gauge field and the gauge genome, the field strikes. So the same way as in ordinary standard model or normal theories, Lorentz-violating operators can be constructed by creating operators which have some Hamming indices, open Lorentz indices, and that is normally done by inserting an extra derivative. In this particular case, especially because we need one more mass dimension compared to four. And in the case of supersymmetry, we use supersymmetric covariant derivatives. So these guys are, and these open Lorentz indices are contracted with arbitrary tensor, background tensors, which are assumed to be constant. And not only they are constant, but they might be different for for every species, and they might be tensor as well. So in supersymmetry, we also have to set up some number of requirements to the lot of other operators, well, the super submitter is what evidence is just, by the way that we build them, they appear to be super submitter. Otherwise, it's not so evident how to make them super submitter. But if one works in terms of the super fields, it's manifest. And they also have to be gauging where. That comes from the demand that one insulation comes from the ultraviolet physics, where all gauge symmetries that we know must be respected. In particular, in this case, this is SPD. And so these two are purely kind of theoretical requirements, such that in grittiness, in component, in ultraviolet fields, the Lagrangian we produce is kind of the same Lagrangian and doesn't have a weird things inside as an unlawful interaction to something. These three requirements are enough to show that the churn silence operator cannot be written in a supersymmetric way, engaging variant at the same time. At the level of dimension 5, we have all three kinds of operators, which is, as you see here, we just insert a variant derivative in the kinetic term. So this is one kind. This is just positively or negatively charged superfluid. In the gauge sector, there are two similar terms constructed out of the field strength and constructed with an external, with some different external pattern. And also there is a F term, which is a tensor term. And it is also possible to write it down at the dimension 5 level. So this is the whole classification, in SPD at the dimension 5 level. So the last remark is that this operator only exists in the abelian theory. In non-abelian theory, it doesn't exist, but there are some other that do. We also give a list of dimension 6 operators, but we don't study them. We didn't study their effects in this work, just for the case of future interest. So listing them, there's a bunch of operators, one gauge operator, and three types of matter operators, which are there's a lot of, as you can see, there's a bunch more choices because we have more indices, and that's why we have more choice. One of the questions that arises here is that it is known that in non-commutative supersymmetry, but one like the dynamics, there exist terms like electromagnetic field strength cube. It is not quite seen from here manifestly, but these two terms do not enter it anywhere here. Well, partly you can see that because there are only two W's, each of which can enable one field strength. And the problem, the explanation why it is induced, they do exist in non-commutative security, they don't exist here, is that in the non-commutative version, there is a different kind of supersymmetry. The whole algebra is modified in the case of supersymmetry, and so the terms do not contradict the modified supersymmetry, but they do contradict the ordinary supersymmetry. One of the reasons why supersymmetry was introduced is that it gets rid of whatever divergences. But somehow there is also an induced problem about D term, which is basically which is basically gauge fee, which can be induced by temple non-zero decomponent, not able to show decomponent in the vector supermodular. But if you integrate the vector supermodulator over the whole superspace, you get the D field, which is an auxiliary field. But if it condenses and it has the vector extension ready, it is also a disaster. And one needs to show that there is no such number. There is no such number because in SVD, the sum of charges is zero. And, there is a charge in the vertex of the diagram. You have to add two diagrams with positive and negative charge, and they cancel. Okay, so I have the vectors to multiply. Yeah, so this is the control which gets induced. But in the Lorentz-violating case, one can show that Lorentz-violating tadpole actually reduces to the ordinary tadpole, which somehow sums up to zero. So this is the solution of this problem. Only at one loop, at higher loops, it's more complicated, as you can see. It's also quite possible to show that. It is zero. There exists a superfilled background gauge formulas where it is pretty much evident that tadpoles don't exist at all. So one cannot try such, one cannot draw such a diagram at all. Because the tail of the tadpole has to be either a connection or a field strength. And in our case of the superfluid V, the vectors to multiply is not either of them. And that's why such tadpole doesn't exist. But this formula is somehow more tricky to use. It's convenient to show very quickly such facts, but it's not very straightforward to use for calculations. Yeah, so the same question about the gauge anomaly. As you can see, there's no gauge anomaly. Yeah, so actually, one can use a stupid method of calculation of the anomaly developed by Gical and show that in the same way the cancellation happened. With the neutron anomaly, if this happens with the gauge anomaly. And so, if over SQD doesn't have a problem, then this theory doesn't have this problem either. And this is quite a generic statement that only working to SQD. So next, we will consider a normalization group evolution of the Wilson coefficients, as I said, because we need to calculate sort of the values at the observation scale rather than the scale at which they're generated. And this is done for calculating loops with explicit Lorentz violation. And we come to the normalization group equation, which can pass some sort. But it turns out that those guys, they don't evolve too much, even if considered evolving from the scale, the max Planck scale, to the solid radio scale. So if they change by some 10%, then you can just define them, say, we don't know where they are coming from, so we just take them at the level, at the scale of the solid radio. As I said, we also need to consider supersymmetric breaking because it is broken, indeed, if it exists, and also because it provides us with much stronger constraints than if it is not broken. And then there is also the question about term size. We've shown with the loop calculations here, it has been shown that neither chloride convergences arise nor any kind of transient strong can arise by the same reason. also because there is no, in many cases, the supersymmetric appearance of this, of the trench side of the stroke. However, if the supersymmetry is broken, then it might get reduced. And dimension three apparatus, which is not being allowed, not being allowed by supersymmetry, now are allowed. This is how it is broken in a convenient form. Mesh cooler formally where one has soft masses as a kind of condensation of some spurious and superfluid, which we don't know about. It's just a convenient way, also a convenient way of calculating on diagrams. So the answer one might suspect is the whole bunch of dimension three operators which we can just list. So we can just write out all of them and with some arbitrary coefficients, and we need just what we need just to calculate. And this is scalar electrons which we don't care about. And this is the electrons which or quarks which we do care about. In the gauge sector, again, this is, there is the Chern-Simon storm, and there is a there's a Gugino interaction, which we also don't care because nobody has ever seen a Gugino. And this demonstrates how the constraints for dimension five operators rise. I mean, as I said, we know how to constrain dimension three operators, and at the tree level, they get enhanced by the soft mass square, and by, at the root level, they get enhanced by the soft mass square, and also actually by the root factor, by the logarithm, which is not here, but it should be. So one must suspect that these operators are the only ones that are important for us, but it turns out that we also have to consider scalar electrons because these two groups of operators intermix with each other in the non-normalization rule. And for example, one of the dimension five operators induces such kind of coefficient by the equations of motion in the tree level. And so then what is done is a straightforward calculation which gives the answer for those coefficients of dimension three operators and induced for dimension five. So dimension five exists by themselves at low scale either, but there are also dimension three operators. So they are all evolved by a big group system for normalization of new equations, but it exacts solving of this system is not really very much really important for us, because we have seen that the change of operators within a big around of scale is not very great. So this is the system of realization group equations, and this is one of the particular approximate solutions of leading logarithm solutions. And so this is dimension three operator, this is a couple of dimension five operators. In the gauge sector, we're again only interested in the trend silence, and what we do is only we're getting convinced that it is not being induced. It is indeed very important because if it leads to certain optical effects which we would already have seen and we have at a very high precision. So and the result is zero, as argued. And there is a more or less famous Kolmogorov theorem, which says that it is actually we could not have done that calculation to see that it wouldn't have been induced. This is a kind of theoretical theorem which considers the Green function. Studies their asymptotics and shows that Chern-Simon storm, which has one derivative and therefore one, it has certain asymptotics, with respect to momentum, capital momentum, and such, there are certain functions, neurologies, and words. So, passing through phenomenology, we need certainly to get the for the component form of the all those or supercode expressions for those Murrayian operators. And well, this particular matter operator, the component form looks like that. Similarly for this one, for all classes to play the analysis. And so this expression is quite deep, but one has to remember that ordinary STV, the kinetic term of ordinary STV is also quite deep. And this term is probably a little bit bigger. But there are only a few terms here which are relevant for phenomenology. And to find them out, one has to do basic mercenary stuff, as to exclude all auxiliary things, D and F, and also apply the equation to motion, where it is possible to, for example, here, the second derivative reduces the operator of the first equation. And this is the only relevant part which comes out to be here. There is a dimensional free operator, but is somehow suppressed by the max of the length, which is a very small word. This can be dealing with. So we need to prove some other notations which are more useful for phenomenology in terms of the electron and positron operators. With similar the gauge field, with the gauge operators, one suspects they're only gauge, only they're relevant only for gauge, but actually one can apply equations of motion for them to infer a matter operator. And similar for the tensor operator, for the superpotential operator, we get a component form which induces another dimension 5 operator of some electrolyter coupled to the electromagnetic field. And we don't care about any gauginous or scalar electrons in that sample, because we cannot constrain that. For direct equivalent constraints, or see what observational consequences is, for instance, for the effects, one needs to get a non-relativistic Hamiltonian out of the Lagrangian. Again, but the first Lagrangian itself. So this is the kind of result of all the calculations, where all dimension 5 operators are grouped into specific terms they induce, each of which has its own different distinct phenomenological consequences.
Is there any just a way you can write down a term like the third one without having the dual of F shutting out by itself?
That would be probably one maybe. If you remove the dual of F, this operator is zero in the equation of motion, actually. One can show that pretty simply. It just doesn't exist. If you remove the dual here. And similarly here.
Who's the equation of motion that does that? The electrons or the.
Of the electrons, yeah. Because the gauge field, the field strength consists of two antisymmetric derivatives, right? And because they are antisymmetric, and they act on this spinner, they produce mass, but with different size, it gets cancelled. So I don't know the reason why it hasn't been produced by supersymmetry, but it doesn't exist at all. So even if it was, it will really be zero. Yeah, okay, so, yeah, so it's well known fact that the frozen operator can remove for generally a massless theory, no, for a massless theory, for an SPD at least, or in QD, sorry, QD, because this is already taken from ordinary quantum electrodynamics. The first guy can be removed by just further definition. And so it doesn't lead to any effects. It's not, or since not like that, no standard model where you have a bunch of different species and you have such a Wilson coefficient for different for every species, if you have infallible mass terms which make it impossible to eliminate this term.
When people always say that, and I always, it's doubtful, because that first term, if you just said, supposing you had nothing but the first term, and you chose A0 to be non-zero, and the space part of A to be zero, then that's the chemical potential for a fermion. Because you just, you've got a constant times the number operator for the fermion. And so, if what you're saying is true, it sounds like there's no physics in the chemical potential, because I can get rid of it by a field definition. And I know that that's not true. I know that the chemical potential is important physically. And I just, so, I don't know if you have a comment about that. I don't really know the resolution myself, but I worry that there's often boundary condition information. And then when people say that, you've got to be careful that you're not doing funny things with Kennedy. And I don't know that anyone's ever thought that through. So how sure are you that A, if you just, supposing you left A in and you just calculated its effects, you should just, if what you're saying is right, Asia should drop out of the answers, right? It's just never here anymore. And if you just by brute force calculate with A, does it drop out, or does it?
Sorry,
supposing I was doubtful of your last line.
Yeah.
The way to really convince me and say that I have to be wrong is just to say that if I just left A in, it just wouldn't appear anywhere. It just, you could do the calculation with A in, and it would just cancel out the answer, because that's the expression of the fact that it's not physical.
Yeah.
Did you ever do that?
No, honestly no. Well, part of the reason we have never been really investigating doing calculations in human free operators themselves to extend the loop calculations. We went to the higher dimensions, so I don't know the answer. But I would think that in a massless theory, or even in a master, you might have dropped out.
Well, the reason I doubt that is it's just that if I had been doing, you know, undergraduate non-relativistic electrons, but with a fermionless surface, fermacy, so I have chemical potential of the electrons.
Yeah.
I think I would have, that's the term I would have heard that. It would have been constant times psi dagger gamma zero psi.
Yeah. I don't know the answer. Just wave heaven, you can do the definition to show that there's no change of the measure due to that definition. That it's gone totally. I think about that. Okay. There's more people on this. Yeah, so from this Lagrangian, what we do is we obtain another realistic low energy Hamiltonian, which explicitly shows us what is where and what effects are where. For example, this is an anomalous magnetic moment for the electron, and this is some other weird interactions we might be getting. This is an interaction of particles spinning with the photon frame, which also has been used quite widely to constrain Lorentz volume theories. So mostly how we do constrain Lorentz dimension 5 operators is that we have a constraint for dimension 3, and there is then a factor of some scale which turns dimension 5 into dimension 3. And that scale is different for a different kind of experiment or observation. And there are a few kinds of them. Few kinds of the scales is the solid breaking scale and the hadronic scale for nuclei effects, and also for other nuclei effects, the scale of electromagnetic field inside the nucleus gives some value of the mass surrender. So what is measured in the experiment is the shift of the energy of levels when an atom is placed in an electromagnetic field, a burning electromagnetic field, and that electric or magnetic field gets flips the side. And then the energy level of the state might change, and that is being measured and constrained. And then one derives its energy shift from this Hamiltonian string forwardly, and then we can apply those constraints to our theory. And we summarize here the basic table, the basic results, which have been obtained. So just from torsion balance experiments, we get some constraints of the electric components of the Lorentz parameters from nuclear spin precession experiments and a bunch of other, which is basically all the same, where a spin or an angular momentum of the particle is coupled to the preferred direction, and that if you flip electromagnetic field, the energy level will change. There is also one constraint coming from the anomalous magnetic moment of the electron, and that is not a direct experiment of searching for insulation. And here to stress that the magnetic moment, anomalous magnetic moment in our theory for the electron does get induced despite the Lorentz theorem, which prohibits that, but it just, the explanation is that in our theory, Lorentz violation is, Lorentz symmetry is violated, and more specifically, the theorem just says that one can apply an operator, a supersymmetric operator, which creates an anomalous magnetic moment for the electron. But if one can try the supersymmetric ones, invariant, but one can write a supersymmetric non-invariant term. That's the explanation of this kind of question. So we, despite it might seem that only some of the components of our vectors or tensors are constraints, certainly not all results are shown here. Other components also do get constrained because of the motion of the Earth with respect to the background. And that induces that if it was located at the rest with respect to this frame, then indeed we would be able only to constrain the corresponding components. But because the Earth is moving with respect to the center of the galaxy, for example, other components do get induced at a level 1,000 as compared to those. So those the different components are also constrained by with some weaker values. What does get constrained by at this stage yet is dimension 6 of error. So we can do some really engraving calculation. Can be shown that they're not yet excluded by the experiment. Whereas it has been known for quite long already, so that dimension 5 operators do not exist. And they have been ruled out basically. The constraints everybody is achieving is saying that the values of these parameters, if they are not zero, then they are unnaturally small. And that is not so with dimension six operators. So we, the basic conclusion is that we have studied the effects induced by dimension five Lorentz operators in SQED and shown that there is no theoretical problems there with respect to anomalies, and also we have studied Susie breaking, soft Susie breaking, in terms of soft masses for the electron and positron. So quadratic divergences and other problems are also being related. And we have shown that transcendence term cannot exist, cannot be induced. It's not that it cannot exist, it cannot be induced by a supersymmetric theory. There are very strong constraints coming from astrophysical observations, and that has to do with the distance to the object we see. So there are really, the further the distance, the more the different observation consequences of light or of the radiation of those objects that we receive would be. And then that creates mostly the highest constraints on Lorentz value operators. But to the highest, some people are a little bit doubtful to some of the results. But in any case, those astrophysical observations cannot be applied to supersymmetric theories, just because the nature of the supersymmetry. This has to do with the dispersion relation to the particles, which are normally modified by cubed terms, but in the supersymmetric case, they are not. They are modified in a different way. I haven't actually shown it here, but it's just mentioned. So the result is that we find that similarly to already known results that Lorentz value parameters are limited by at level 10 to the minus 12. In general, this is not quite English, results are not quite known well in the sense that it is already known to say that dimension five operators are real. But we know that theories which predict dimension five for installation therefore has potential phenomenological problem. This might be solved by some of the discrete singers, which we didn't mention, for example, CPP. And dimension six operators are CPP invariant, as in contrast to dimension five. And they are either also not excluded by experiment yet. They also, in the case of supersymmetry, they also don't lead to modification to that kind of modification of the special relations, which can be limited from astrophysical observations. Therefore, we find quite interesting to study the case of dimension six planetary operators within the framework for all the full means for symmetric standard model. And this is the credits. And I wanted to mention that also Next, if some people don't know, the next Marcel Grossman meeting is going to happen in Petersburg. Even those people who are not interested in gravity are certainly welcome to see. Okay, thanks.
What is that?
This is along the central streets in Petersburg.
Now, when is the Marcel Grossman meeting in Petersburg?
When? This is in next summer, 2016.
Could you show the slide again, which shows presses the ends in terms of the parameters?
Show what?
Your balance around these NIs and NAIs.
Okay.
Can you show the previous slide? I think you wrote what the ends were in terms of the things of the Lagrangian.
Lagrangian.
What's, I guess I'm asking, what I'd like to ask, what are the definitions of the ends again?
Oh.
Red ends.
And the red ends, so this is the explicit efficiency of the dimension part of layers, which we are seeking.
So these are the things like the 5 plus, red maybe 5.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. And V and A is just symmetric and axiosymmetric?
Okay. Yeah, exactly. This is just an actual, this is a linear combination plus the coefficients, which means the coefficients.
So the message is that for the electron, those things are poison.
For the electron, sorry, yes.
Those are bad things for the electron. Your balance were for electrons, right?
Yeah.
And then what would be the analog of the, how bad, so the...
So the bonds on the table are not only for the electron, some bonds for quarks, for
what we show those in the table?
Like on the next slide, I'm sorry.
Right, so now the top line, that's electrons, right?
Yes. And
so you're saying the other ones are not electrons?
The third one is the atom, which is basically, again, the electron. Because it's made of electrons. But the second one is not, it's for neutrons.
Does atom be for any quark
press,
any fermion? Which appears in the nucleon in a reasonable amount.
Yeah.
So the up and down works.
Yeah.
But it's not, for the muon, for instance, there's no limit.
Not for the muon. For the muon, yeah, we need to go to the full of the system.
Happens a lot. Oh, yeah, okay.
Like there is no great experiments for the muon, I think, but once you can derive it, you know, it's through the normalization loop mixed.
It's probably true that you know that the anomalous magnetic moment for the V plus and V minus are the same with some accuracy. I don't know what the accuracy is.
I don't really know about the muon. Probably also that they know, but maybe not with that kind of precision as for the electron.
Your number here, the 10 to the 10 number, that's coming from, that is 10 to the plus 10, right? That's 10 minus 10.
Yeah.
And that's coming from the electron.
Yeah, this is for the electron. Right.
Okay. One more question would be, the supersymmetry algebra that you're realizing with your, if I'm going to ask what's the asymmetry algebra? It sounds like that by using the normal supersymmetry rules, you're assuming that the algebra is a standard algebra where Q with Q dagger anti-commutative give you P mu gamma mu.
Yeah.
And in particular, you're assuming that the normalization there of the energy, P0, is the same as the normalization of the momentum. And and when you derive those supersymmetry algebras, you know, there's this high Wolfensky-Stonius theorem that says that that's the most general algebra that you could possibly have. But that assumes Lorentz invariance when it does it, because it uses the Jacobian identity. So let me get the question for answer. I guess the question would be, do you know if there's a similar statement for what the algebra, supersymmetry algebra, has to be in a non-Lorentz invariant case? Is there a similarity?
So we don't modify the supersymmetry algebra.
Well, right, and that's an assumption.
Because we don't start from a hard Lorentz breaking where there has been no Lorentz invariance at all. So if you just consider an arbitrary Lagrangian made up of different terms with different indices not contracted in any way, we just assume that nature has been invariant at a certain scale, then it was kind of spontaneously broken. And if it was spontaneously broken, then we're kind of vacuum where we're actually kind of solution of the equations of motion. That means that the Lagrangian actually still was invariant, Lorentz invariant, and supersymmetric invariant. So the same algebra remains the same. All algebras remain the same, and just kind of the solution is not Lorentz invariant, but we're just diving into an effective low-energy theory where we have some intrinsic, this manifests as having some intrinsic vectors and backgrounds. So this is a really not a convincing explanation for everyone, and I would say so for those who don't accept it as an explanation, but as an assumption, we are seeing that supersymmetric algebra is not changed. And
right.
It's
so,
just kind of justification.
So I mean, if your basic assertion was that under three assumptions, the dimension four and dimension three terms are not there, and one of them was supersymmetry, it sounds like actually supersymmetry is like, once you drop Lorentz invariance, supersymmetry is more than one thing. So there's many supersymmetry algebras you could have written down, probably. And you're really saying that a specific kind of supersymmetry, which is the one you would have had in the Lorentz invariant limit, is the one that forbids these dimension four terms.
Yeah. We just justify why we use this kind of ordinary supersymmetry. So we can justify that, we can prove that or argue that that's the only way. But it just seems to be very obvious that if one starts to consider in general modification of supersymmetry algebra, it would be really, really difficult to break through anything.
It'd be nice to know if you actually, if it was possible to spontaneously break Lorentz invariance, it'd be nice to know what algebra you would get. And even though in your first slide you gave a whole bunch of motivations of things that could break Lorentz invariance, it's true that in all those things you showed, nobody has an example does anybody have an example where you take a theory which has energy bound from below and you plug in your list, the last one I think was quantum gravity, just put that one aside because I don't know, that's a different set of assumptions. But in the string theory and other cases, if you ask for theories with vector field to tensor field and you ask for an expectation value for one of them to develop, does anyone have a controllable calculation of a model where that happens, where a tensor field actually acquires an expectation value?
As far as I know, there is no good example of condensation of a vector or even tensor field. So there are attempts of some sort of maximal paths how to produce VEVs for vectors, but there's no good and trustable kind of things mechanism which
generally they run into the obstacle that as soon as you give these guys an X and a half, you give them a mass more or less, and then the Goldstone boson that they would have eaten, the negative sign of the mass term becomes a negative kinetic energy of these Goldstone bosons. And so that's kind of a barrier to having, that means the energy wasn't bounded from below. And so that makes it difficult to kind of know what the right algebra is, because there's no example to take and work it out to see what the low energy algebra is. Okay, so it'd be nice to have a model where you can see what the algebra was.
This percent of your algebra?
Yeah.
that's not, you know, there's no reason, that's not a particular problem to you, it's just everybody has that problem.
Any other questions? Who's going to talk?
Somebody has to, because the signature is, somebody's the wrong thing.
That's the same one.
Yeah, exactly, it has a wrong thing.
All right, then.
Well, no, so I must have put the conflict back, because the normal thing QD is that if you just quantize things coherently, that A0 is the wrong sign. Then the dwarf kills that A0. They have the right sign of the wrong sequence. If you're talking about Fichte's line out here, it seems to double up like, strictly speaking, it seems that there's a, I put it because it seems there's a one-pushy thing here.